good morning to all of you. I would ask you to turn to 1 Samuel. And as you do so, see if you can find chapter 4. We're going to do just a little bit of reviewing, a little bit of overlapping with what we've already talked about in order to make this start correctly. The story that we've seen so far focuses on Samuel. Samuel was the child of God's gift, promised to God before his birth. He has been turned over to Eli the priest to serve in God's house of worship, place of worship, for all of his life. At the end of the time last year, we noticed a couple of things. We noticed, first of all, that God spoke through Samuel. I think we got to that part last week, right? Did we get to that part last week? I think so. We did not? Okay. I'm about to start further back than I further forward than I needed to. Okay. All right, so we must have ended with chapter 2. I was thinking we'd ended with chapter 3. All right, let me back up just a little bit then. At the end of what we were looking at last time, we saw in chapter 2, verse 26, a statement about Samuel that was parallel with a statement in the Gospels about Jesus. He grew in stature and in favor with both men and with people. There was then two or three different times when God spoke to Eli about his sons and their conduct. They were supposedly taking over the priestly functions, but they had been evil. Eli himself talked to them in verse 22 of chapter 2, and then in verse 27 of chapter 2, a man of God, that's the phrase that's used in my translation, came and talked to him about the same thing, warning him that the outcome was going to be awful if they did not change their ways. Okay, so we haven't gotten to chapter 3, right? All right, look at chapter 3, verse 1 then. Chapter 3, verse 1 has a very interesting statement. The boy Samuel was serving the Lord in the presence of Eli. Mine has a semicolon and then has a very important sentence. What does yours say there?
And.
The whole phrase. What's the? The voice of the Lord, the word from the Lord. Mine says it was rare for the Lord to speak. A word from the Lord was rare in those days. Mine adds visions were uncommon. And it proceeds to tell you about a vision that Samuel had. You've read this, right? This was your assignment for last time, was to read further forward into 1 Samuel. Samuel goes to bed. It has told you in verse 2 and 3 that Eli was getting to the point where he was having trouble seeing. The lamp of God had not yet gone out, it says, which may be reference to his vision. It may be reference to one of the utensils that was in the temple. And the Lord called to Samuel. What was Samuel's response the first time? He went running to Eli and said, "What do you need?" And Eli said, "I didn't call you." Samuel goes back to bed. God calls again. "Samuel, Samuel," he says. And the second time, what did he do? Samuel goes running to Eli. "My father, what do you need?" "I didn't call you, my son. Go back and lay down." The third time that God called, Samuel goes back to Eli. And here's what I want you to make sure you notice. Eli has a relationship with God that carries with it power and God's indwelling. He hasn't been able to pass that on to his sons, but Eli himself has that. Eli had enough sense from God to realize what was happening. What did he say to Samuel? "Go back and lay down. If you hear that voice again, here's what you're to say." What was he to say?
"Speak, Lord.
Speak, Lord.
For your servant is listening."
For your servant is listening. One of the issues that I think we have is the voice of the Lord was rare, maybe because God wasn't speaking, but possibly because nobody was listening. That's that's an interesting question that I think the words here are introducing. And that's what they did. Verse 10, the Lord calls the fourth time. Samuel gives his answer, and God begins to speak. And God begins to talk of rainbows and sunshine, of flowers and rain, of gardens and beauty, right? No. What does God talk about? The absolute destruction of Eli's family and of the pain and suffering that's going to come. Verse 14, I swear it to the family of Eli, no sacrifice or offering will ever expiate the guilt of Eli's family. Hard, hard words. Verse 15, the tail end of the verse, it says something about Samuel. What does it say? He didn't want to tell Eli what he had heard. Why not?
Bad news.
Eli might not want to hear it. Plus, if he genuinely liked Eli, and the impression you get is that Eli's problem was his inability to lead his sons, and that was bringing disaster on him. You can be a good person, but if the actions that you take are not successful, tragedy can still come. Eli called Samuel and said, Samuel, my son. What do you think had happened most mornings before now? Have you been around a child in the morning? I'm checking to see if your experience has been similar to some that we've had. Who's the first one up? The kid. Sort of in your face. Are you awake yet? Right? And you have the feeling that for the first time, Samuel's not there. And Eli calls him in. What message did the Lord give you? Please do not hide it from me. And Samuel, verse 18, told him everything, hiding nothing from him. And what's Eli's response? First part, he is God. Let him do what he thinks is good. That is the response of somebody who is faithful, but it's tragic what all that he's caught up in. Samuel grew up, the Lord was with him, and did not let a single word fall to the ground of all he had told him. I don't think I'd ever read that verse properly until this week, as I was finishing up thinking about what we would talk about today. Does Scripture say, it doesn't let any word that Samuel says fall to the ground, meaning not come true or not be true? Is that what it says? Read yours again. Whose word is being held up? The Lord's word to Samuel. And that's slightly different from saying he didn't let anything Samuel said not be true. Verse 20, all of Israel knew from where to where. What would be the parallel for us? If you ignore Alaska and Hawaii, you might say from Miami to Seattle. You might say from San Diego to Bangor, right? You might say from Washington to San Francisco. Something that takes, one of these is in the far south, one of these is in the far north. They're saying all of Israel, and they're naming the extremes of this, knew something. What did they know? That Samuel was a prophet of the Lord. Okay? Would you please turn over to chapter 7, verse 15. What does it say about Samuel in chapter 7, verse 15? He was a judge over Israel all his life. And it talks about he's a circuit rider. You've heard of circuit judges. Nowadays, my impression is they all stay in one place. But it used to be they'd ride a circuit. They'd ride. How are you old enough to have seen circuit riders?
Well, and now they don't stay in one place. So, like the Powhatan judge, that's the Powhatan. That's the Amelia.
So they do still rotate between courthouses. Well, I'm glad to know that. That's what this is doing, right? Samuel was the last of the judges, and other than Moses, first of the prophets. And I want you to see those two things. Back to chapter 3, the last verse. The Lord continued to manifest himself at Shiloh, revealing himself to Samuel there. What does the word manifest mean? What does the word manifest mean? It means a list of things that are in a shipment. No, no, no. That's not the word we need here. We need the other meaning of manifest. To reveal in a solid, tangible way. So he talks about revealing himself to Samuel, but he talks also about making himself manifest at Shiloh. You have the sense that as people came from worship, remember how the book started? Here's this family coming once a year to worship at Shiloh. That those who came began to see God's presence in a way that was real and solid to them, and he continued to reveal himself to Samuel. And it continues, and for all of Israel, the word of Samuel was the same as the word of God. That's the way it's supposed to work for a prophet. And then it says, the reason for that, because Eli was very old and his sons persisted in their wicked behavior towards the Lord. I can imagine there might have been some tension between Eli's sons and Samuel. But I don't get a sense that tension ever got anywhere. Why not? Sometimes arrogant, brutal people are cowards. And you have a sense that they saw a reality in Samuel. At least Scripture doesn't ever talk about a confrontation between them. Okay, that's chapter 3. Any comments or questions on chapter 3? Okay, chapter 4. Chapter 4 is awful. Chapter 4 is awful. I'm still in a very long verse 1, and yours is somewhere close by there. It happened at that time, mine says. Does yours have something like that? Mine's, in my translation, it's in the middle of verse 1 of chapter 4. Yours may be the last of chapter 3, the first of chapter 4, somewhere in there. It happened at that time that the Philistines mustered to make war on Israel, and Israel went out to meet them in war, pitching camp near a place called Ebenezer. Let's agree to call it Ebenezer for this morning. While the Philistines pitched their camp at, let's agree to call it Aphek. Okay? Now, I always thought mustard was something you put on hot dogs, but apparently there's a military force that's... What does it mean to muster? It means to gather together. Okay? Gather together, and they're ready to march, and probably are marching. Somehow Israel knows this. Presumably they've got spies out. Maybe elements of the CIA have frontline positions where they can watch from the hills. Verse 2, the Philistines drew up their battle line against Israel. The fighting was fierce, and who won? Philistines won. Israel was beaten by the Philistines. 4,000 men in their ranks were killed on the field of battle. When the troops returned to camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has God caused us to be beaten by the Philistines today?" And then they get a bright idea. What's their bright idea? Let's treat God's ark as a talisman, as almost a good luck piece. If we bring it up, surely everything will be fine. Long story short, which seldom happens in here, they bring the ark up, and what happens? The Philistines take the ark. When the Philistines heard the noise of the war cry, they said, "What can this great war cry in the Hebrew camp mean?" Verse 7, they realized the ark of the Lord had come into the camp. At this, the Philistines were terrified, for they said, "God has come into the camp." Disaster, they said. Nothing like this has ever happened before. Disaster. Who will rescue us from the clutches of this mighty God? This was the God who struck down Egypt with every kind of misfortune in the desert. But take courage and be men, Philistines, or you'll become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been slaves to you. As they have been slaves to you. The Philistines had already been in control of all this. Be men and fight. And they fought. And they won. Tail end of verse 10. The slaughter was very great on the Israel side. How many died? 30,000, mine says. The ark of God was captured too. And the two sons of Eli died. What happens in the rest of the chapter? Word comes back to Eli, and verse 18 says, when the fellow who brought the word about the loss of God's ark, what happened with Eli?
He
Mine says he fell. Yours say how?
Backward.
Did it say? Does it say why? Old and
heavy.
What a kind word to have used at that spot. There are other more pejorative words that could have been used at that spot. Old and heavy is plenty. Fell backwards off his seat by the gate, broke his neck, and died. How long had he been judge? 40 years. And the next four verses are even worse. One of his two sons have died, and he has died, all on the same day, just as God had foretold through Samuel and through the man of God who came earlier. But one of his daughters-in-law, turned out, when she heard this news, she went into labor, and in the process of giving birth, she died. But just before she died, she gave the child a name, and it's a very famous name. You may not have ever known what it meant, but it's a very famous name. What's the name?
Ichabod.
And what does that mean? The glory of God is gone. If you go back into the early part of what we've studied in this study, these first five books, you find that when God's tabernacle was first consecrated, the glory of God filled it, and what filled it was visible smoke, the same smoke and fire, pillar of smoke by day, pillar of fire by night that led the people through the wilderness. God's glory had been a physical presence, and her statement was, the glory of God has gone from Israel. The glory has gone from Israel because the ark of God has been captured. That's chapter 4. Right about here, you're allowed to smile. Right about here, you're allowed to smile. But it sneaks up on you. Now the question is, the Philistines have captured the Ark of God. What do they do with it? What does someone who is profane, someone who has no regard for the Lord, do with the objects that are used in God's worship? The objects that signify the presence of God among the people. Now, before we start reading, I want to ask you, is there any parallel in the Bible to this story? To this moment? Is there a parallel? It was in the book of Daniel, I think. Some people had taken over the nation of Israel. Had plundered the temple, including all of the vessels that had been used in the. Remember that worship included eating, and worship included drink. They had plates of gold and silver, cups of gold and silver, and the king that had controlled all of this brought his officers together, his people of leadership, and basically had an orgy. And in this orgy, they brought out the temple vessels, and they were eating and drinking out of this in the presence of idols, stone gods, wooden gods. You remember what happened? Nothing but a hand appeared. And the king went almost catatonic with fright. And the hand wrote on the wall. If you've heard the phrase, the finger has written, and once it's written, nothing in the world can erase it. Remember what it wrote? Many, many, Parkle, I think, up Farson, is that what I remember? Which means you've been weighed in the balance and found wanting, and your kingdom will be divided between the Medes and the Persians. This kind of thing is not good. Chapter 5, 1 Samuel. What's the first thing that happens? Where did they take it? They took it to the holiest place they had, the temple of their god, whose name was
Dagon.
What was the god that they worshipped? No, Dagon. We're still talking about Dagon. What was it that they worshipped when they worshipped Dagon? Some big idol statue that they had put up. What do we know about that statue? It appeared to look like a person or some other living thing. How do we know that? Because it had hands, and it had, I don't think it said arms. Did it say arms or did it say hands?
It
It
had a head. And it had hands, I think is what it mentioned. And so you have this picture, right? So they put the ark in there, and what do? They go home happy. They won a great battle, right? Here's the evidence of our great battle. We've taken the loot in there. They come in the next morning. What do they see? The statue is out of its place. Where is it? Face down in front of the ark. What did they do? You're allowed to smile. What did they do? Put it back up. Now, here's what's interesting. That God was not going to put itself back up. They put it back up. Next morning, what did they find? The trunkless body was laying in front of the ark. And this is where I said I'm pretty sure it had heads and hands because they mentioned it at this point. Where were those? Sitting across the threshold of the doorway into the temple. And they say something about the superstition that drew up from that nobody would step on a doorstep there. There's a doorstep at the University of Richmond. You have to know where it is. But if you step on that doorstep, it makes the loudest noise you've ever seen. It's somewhere between a crack and a bang, and it's all happening at once. There's a classroom just to your right with windows all the way across it. And if you step on that threshold, which I seem to do every time I go through that door, I don't remember to watch for this. It makes this big, awful sound. That's why I'm trying not to step on that threshold, not because of this. Okay? So, verse 6 tells you it gets worse. What happens now? And I need to have as many translations as we have at this point. The Lord oppressed the people of, what's the city?
Ashdod.
How many cities were there in Philistine? There were five big cities, each with its own chief. You remember this from another day? This was one of their five chief cities, Ashdod. Everybody still okay? He oppressed the people of Ashdod. Oppressed. That's my first verb. What's your first verb? Heavy upon them, ravaged them, brought devastation on them. Semicolon, he ravaged, not ravished, but ravaged them and afflicted them. That's two more verbs. What do yours have for those two verbs? Brought devastation. That's the second verb is brought devastation. Okay. And mine says he afflicted them with what? Now, you need to get all the translations here because there should be at least two words here and most translations have one word. Not yet. There is a translation out there that says it correctly. A plague of tumors. Which really probably should be translated plague and tumors. Where does plague come from? This is one of the early mentions of plague. There will be some more in the Bible. Where? How does it come to spread? Rats. It's not really the rats, we found out much later. It's the fleas on the rats, right? This is plague. And what does plague normally do? Kills you. Okay? What do the tumors do? They hurt you like crazy. So, there's a translation that says a plague of tumors, and it probably should say both. What's my evidence for this? What comes later is my evidence for this. Now, I need to know if there's any other translation just for this right here. Yours says tumors, so does mine. Mine says tumors with two U's because this is a sort of a British spelling. Struck them with tumors. But I'm looking for the word tumors. Does anybody have King James? Because it doesn't say tumors in King James. E-M-E-R-O-D-S. Which means... You've said it three times, two times, you're going to get to say it three. Yeah, that's what they're saying. Did you hear? Yeah. That seems to be, and the translators seem to be delicate enough that they decided they don't want you to know that, and so they're going to use a kinder term. And you have the feeling that the person writing this does not have a whole lot of sympathy for the people of Ashdod. If you get plague, what's probably going to happen to you? You're going to die. If you get the tumors, and now I'm going to just use that term, what happens? You get really, really, really uncomfortable and painful and all that kind of stuff, right?
And still may die.
Ashdod and its territory. So you're talking about the metropolitan area got caught in this. It wasn't just the inner city. When the people of Ashdod saw what was happening, they said, and I think this is the first logical, thoughtful statement that's been made in this section. What did they say? Let's move the ark. Where? Let's take it to Gath. What's Gath? Another one of the major cities. So they take it to Gath. This is verse tail end of verse 8. Verse 9. What happens in Gath? A plague of tumors breaks out there, afflicting the people of the town from the highest to the lowest. What do the people of Gath do? They're smart. They can see a pattern here. They take it to Ekron. But when they tried to take it to Ekron, what did the people of Ekron say? We don't want it here. And so now they're sitting there scratching their heads, among other things, and trying to decide. Sorry. There is a comedian who at points like that looks up at the sky and says, Lord, forgive me for that one. Verse 11, verse 10, when it came to Ekron, the Ekronites, I love that term, does yours say Ekronites? The Ekronites shouted, they brought me, the ark of the God of Israel, to kill me and my people. They summoned all the Philistine chiefs and said, send the ark of the God of Israel away. Let it go back to where it belongs and not kill me and my people. For there was mortal panic throughout the town. God was oppressing them, mine says. The people who did not die were afflicted with tumors, and the wailing from the town rose to the sky. How long was the ark in Philistine territory? First verse of chapter 7. Interesting that it's chapter 7. How long were they there? 7 months. That's a long time for people to be dying of plague and suffering from tumors. The Philistines then called for their priests and diviners or diviners, and said, what shall we do with the ark of the Lord? That turns out to be a powerful question. That turns out to be a powerful question. And as you watch the ark of the Lord through the remainder of this part of the Bible, you will find every once in a while people who do not treat the visible symbols of God's presence tend to have some pretty significant problems. Some people die. And I'm not sure I know what to do with all of that, but I just point that out as we go by. Tell us how to send it back where it belongs. The priests and diviners, mine just says they, replied, well, if you send the Ark of God back, you certainly can't send it without gifts. You must have gifts to go with it. You must pay him a guilt offering. You will recover and will realize why he was continually oppressing you. And they asked, what guilt offering ought we to pay? So what do they do? How many? Why five? Five cities of the Philistines. The cities that haven't yet been afflicted are happy to pay this. The ones who have been afflicted maybe resent paying it. Maybe the ones that have been afflicted should pay it all. But anyway, objects made of gold representing what? Rats and tumors. Rats and tumors. I can't think of any more disgusting object than this. Yes, Willie.
I'm a little confused because I remember back in the beginning it was prohibited for anyone to go near or touch the Ark of the Covenant.
That's correct.
And here they talk about filling it so they don't send it back in.
My translation doesn't say that they put this in it. Mine says, and it says it specifically later, they put it in a box beside it. My picture is that when the ark was carried to the battlefield, it would have been on something that was movable, and my sense is they kept moving it. There is a time later where somebody touches the ark to steady it when the cart was there, and that person died. And that's what I said, that treating this without the proper respect seems to bring all kinds of consequences. Okay? Now, we're almost out of time, so let's summarize. What was the plan they came? They're going to make golden models of rats and tumors. Disgusting, disgusting. I really wonder what happened to those things later. I don't know if they stayed in that form or if they were melted down so the disgust would go away. They put them, mine says, in a box next to it. And then what did they do? They found a couple of cows that had just given birth to calves. They locked the calves up over here, and they hitched the cows, which had never been hitched to anything before, to the cart. And the priests and the diviners said, "You watch what happens with those cows." Cows would never leave their calves. So this is a tough test. Watch where they go. If they turn and go straight toward Israel, then you know God is behind this. He's been oppressing you, and this was a real smart thing for you to have done. If they turn around and go back to their calves, then God has nothing to do with it. Which way did the cows go? Straight toward Israel. Straight toward Israel. Verse 12, they made straight for Beth Shemesh, keeping to one road, lowing as they went, turning neither to the right nor the left. The Philistines' chiefs followed them as far as they could to the border of Beth Shemesh. You have the picture of Beth Shemesh being an Israeli town, an Israelite town, on the border. So what do you think the people of Beth Shemesh said when they saw this thing coming? This is maybe not a good idea. They were rejoicing. Did all of them rejoice? Go to verse 19 of chapter 6. Did all of them rejoice?
No.
You read verse 19, right? Chapter 6, verse 19. There was one family that didn't rejoice. What happened? They all died. You wonder how. You sort of suspect plagues and tumors. The people mourned because they had struck them so fiercely. And they said in verse 20, "My goodness, what can we do with this?" And they send it on to another town, that same pattern that you saw in Philistia. They welcomed it at first. They burned the cart, which implies now that they, Willie, this is where I have a little bit of a problem, because it looks like maybe they touched it. But it also says Levites from the town came out to handle this, so maybe the Levites would have known the proper way to do this. In any event, they used the cart as a fire. They slaughtered the cows and had a sacrifice there. And then they thought, well, maybe this wasn't such a good idea when the people who had not had respect were killed. And so they sent it on. When it's sent on, chapter 7, verse 1, the men of Kiriath-Jearim came up, took the ark of the Lord, brought it to the house of Abinadab, and consecrated his son Eleazar. Don't get Ebenezer and Eleazar confused. And what was Eleazar's job? To guard the ark of the Lord. And that's where it sits. Now we're going to have to stop there. But I will tell you, it starts to get interesting past that point. Not that it isn't interesting up to this point. I commend to you the reading of the rest of chapter 7. When chapter 7 ends, you're at a break point. Chapter 8 starts a very different kind of context, and it's very important that you start reading that. I think you're probably safe if you have read up to about verse 15. If you've gone up to about verse 15, then you've read chapter 15. You've read what I need you to read for next time. Okay? I don't know that this has been the most fulfilling week, but we are walking through Scripture, and I want you to try to see what's here. So let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, you have taught us that when we come to worship, we should come with respect, with awe, and not treat being in your presence as something to take lightly. We begin to get glimpses through passages like this of the seriousness that you take worship in. And yet at the same time, you accept us just as we are. And you actually come to meet us like the father with the prodigal son went to run and see his son when his son finally returned. Somehow we try to put all these things together. We see your sternness, but we also see your love and your concern. Help us sort all these things out to where we see you well and see you as you are. For we ask this in your son's name. Amen.